are for another episode of Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM human-crafted radio. This show is also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have a bunch of wonderful programs out there. If you're looking for help, addiction, mental health, please check out New Vista Behavioral Health. I'm your host, Wes Geer. Should I have said that first? Maybe. I don't know. And why are we here? Having a Rock to Recovery radio show. Well, I'm a sober dude. Somehow I didn't die. And a lot of us, when we get into recovery, you know, we've come from such dark, scary, death-defying spots, and you find a way out, you just want to share it with everybody. And so this show is given to me. It's a great opportunity for me to bring on guests. We have rock stars and actors and pro athletes and just all sorts of rad humans that have each their own incredible story, overcoming incredible odds, not just to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, you know, addiction, mental health, or whatever, but to get into what I like to call the vortex of radness. What we learn is that when we recover, it isn't just like some dim life. It's the brightest life we've ever known to be. And so we love to share that on Rock to Recovery Radio by talking about things like mental health and addiction. Together we help each other recover. So this week, I'm super excited about my guest. I mean, legendary dude right here. Cool spirit too. This gentleman, and he is a gentleman, is a well-known keyboardist. And he played, this is what blows me away, with George Clinton, if you think of P-Funk, and Peter Tork, Marty Friedman, Snoop Dogg, Isaac Hayes, and most recently, and maybe most known for his stint with Lynyrd Skynyrd. So welcome to the show, my man, Peter Keys. Welcome to Rock to Recovery Radio.
Thank you, Wes. And thank you, Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm really happy to be here in your vortex of radness.
Yeah. Are you living in Nashville these days?
Yes.
Yeah, you are, right. So they probably don't say vortex of radness that much out in Nashville.
I'm going to start that, though.
Well, please do, man. Please do. And we got to give a shout out to our man, Phil Bogard, or what we call Nash Phil, for linking us up. Phil's a new but dear friend of mine, and he's doing Rock to Recovery out in Nashville, and you guys are our buddies. And so we got to give a shout out to Phil for linking us together and making this all possible.
Nashville, thank you for hooking us up, brother.
That's right. That's right. So let's get into it. I do usually, you know, the format of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And I'm always curious, and I think our listeners are too, to hear about the origins of the guests. And for some people, you know, childhood maybe isn't too relevant. Others, it feels extremely relevant. Where does right. Peter Keys, and I'm not going to try to say your original last name. Where does Peter Keys' story start?
Well, yeah, you want to hear my story? Oh boy! All right, pull up a chair and a bucket. You know,
get out some popcorn.
There you go. Yeah. Well, you know, I was born in, you know, into a really good, safe, loving family. So, like, you know, I can't blame them for anything. I was born in 1965, which puts me right dead smack in the middle of the whole hippie counterculture thing, which I also can't blame, but I can definitely, you know, accept some influence from.
It didn't hurt. It didn't hurt
it
the
did
agenda.
Hurt. Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of experimentation going on, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I considered myself a scientist, so I was like, okay, I'm a human chemistry set. Let's see what this does. What does this do? You know? Yeah. All in the name of a good time, right?
I get almost that.
Literally lost it all in the name of a good time.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I've been playing music my whole life. Started playing piano when I was four. Started my first band when I was 12. You know, played all through middle school, high school. Started, you know, doing gigs and clubs. And when I was way too young to be in clubs and, you know, hanging out with all the cool kids, they were drinking and smoking weed. And so I started drinking and smoking weed and then, you know, eating acid and doing whatever else I could find because I thought that was, you know, how to be cool, right? I really, sure. really have a deep need to be accepted, right?
That's your my basic, story. Totally.
Yeah, your basic round peg, square hole kind of situation.
So where were you growing up?
I was growing up in Northern California, just out of San Francisco, Marin County.
Okay, yeah, there was some good hippie culture there.
Oh, yeah, the Grateful Dead. And like, yeah. You know, and Owsley made some really good acid, and I got my hands on a bunch of it.
So so your high school and the home, family, mom, dad's normal. They were there. Everything was just kind of, should I say, average, nothing crazy?
Well, what is normal, really? Come on.
Exactly. What is normal?
Yeah. My parents divorced when I was about 12, and that actually gave me a lot of free time to experiment.
Yeah.
You know.
Did they fight a lot back? Did you
no.
get excited? Uh-huh. No, it's pretty chill.
Nope. Super chill. You know, but again, I was left unsupervised most of my adolescence. So, you know, I kind of got into stuff.
And how was school for you? What kind of student were you? Because, if you're shredding piano at four.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was saying, if you're shredding piano at four, you got a brain on you, but, I feel like I have a pretty good brain, but school was not my jam. Did you have a normal school life?
Yeah, you know, school wasn't my jam, but it was really easy for me, man. You know, like learning and stuff. I actually just got bored and quit performing scholastically. By probably my senior year in high school, I'd figured out how to take 3 or 4 art classes and a couple cooking classes so I could go get high, make art, and eat.
You know? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, yeah. I get it. I was the same way in high school.
Yeah, so I kind of, you know, I cracked the code, if you will.
But there was weren't getting in trouble or getting kicked out as your king.
Oh, no, I was getting in trouble all the time, but I somehow managed to weasel my way out. Because as addicts and alcoholics, we are pretty intelligent beings and individuals, figuring out how to use around people and, you know, avoid consequences. So I skated, man. I literally slipped through the cracks. And, you know, I do remember sitting in the principal's office and the principal calling my mom saying, "I've got Peter here and I think he's holding. Can I check his pockets?" She said, "Let me talk to him." She put me on the phone and I was like, "Hey, mom." She's like, "Are you holding?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay." I said, "No, you can't check him." So, you know, I was kind of
enabled. Wow. So the parents had your back.
Oh, yeah. They totally have my back.
So that's interesting. That's a great story. When did you first get loaded? What was it that you first loaded?
Well, I was 12, you know, went to my aunt's wedding and all the adults, aunts and uncles were drinking and there was a 6-pack in the fridge. I was the oldest of all the nieces and nephews and I was like, "They're drinking, I'm going to try this." And I had, you know, grabbed a Miller High Life out of the fridge and slammed it so I wouldn't get caught, drink it real fast. And I immediately felt the buzz. I was like, "Oh, this is great." And I ended up drinking the whole 6-pack.
Now,
you know?
That's amazing. Now, you weren't like, "Ooh." Now think about it. If it was chocolate cake, right, and you're just going to sneak a little bit, you wouldn't shove the whole cake in your mouth. You'd take a little sample and maybe not get caught. So there must have been some, you must have understood that this gives an effect because you needed all of it. Where'd you learn that from?
From that first beer.
But how'd you know to pound the beer? Like, were you used to seeing adults who were drinking and getting a little buzz on?
No, because I didn't want to get caught. I knew it was bad.
Yeah.
So I drank it fast. Like, if I drink this real fast, and I didn't realize that gave you an extra buzz. So, you know, that was my first experience with alcohol. And then, you know, I kind of drank every chance I could. It was, you know, it's not readily available to a 12 and 13 year old. So I'd, you know, sneak into the liquor cabinet and, you know, I'd go babysit for the neighbors and sneak into their liquor cabinet. And, you know, it was,
you're seeking it out.
Yeah. Oh, totally planning it. But, you know, like I said, I made it, you know, all the way through high school without getting busted per se. I did get arrested, you know, hitchhiking back from a gig or something, and they were going to take me to home. They brought me to the police station, and I ran out the door and like ditched, and then got caught again.
Oh man,
hitchhiking again, and I was drunk, you know, coming back from a gig, about 17, I think, and I think I spent my 18th birthday in juvie because my mom was down on a vacation with her boyfriend or some shit. But again, you know. Unsupervised, right?
Yeah.
So I want that's how it started.
Can we go back to that episode in high school? So, right, you were in the principal's office, and your mom, and they wanted to search you, and so they called your mom, and then you were holding, so it wasn't probably booze.
No, it was weed.
It was weed. Yeah. So when did you start smoking weed, and so it seems like your mom knew you were smoking weed.
I started smoking weed when I was about 13. When my parents had split up, me and my brother and sister moved to California with my mom. And again, it was in Marin County, which is a very hippie kind of culture. And, you know, everybody had weed. So I stole weed from my mom's boyfriend and, you know, tried to smoke it a couple times. I didn't get high. I'm like, this is bullshit. And then finally... Finally, it hit me. I was like, you know, like third or fourth time I smoked it, I was like, oh, wow. And I had like a super psychedelic experience. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. Because, see, I wasn't really into alcohol. It made me feel really out of control and kind of just, you know, it just didn't feel right. Weed felt really right. So I was a pothead for a long time. You know, and I just actually realized this. I was like, wait a minute. I never liked booze until... I ran out of everything else to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Common story.
And then it was on. So.
So, your mom, she was okay with you smoking weed?
She wasn't okay with me smoking weed, but she was less okay with me getting in trouble at school, I suppose.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I like looking back at that stuff. My dad, was we never talked about it, but he sure made sure he didn't notice.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, look, this is a family disease. The denial is just on all points. You know, there's no, you know, it's really painful to bring that stuff into the open because, I mean, that's a fail as a parent, right? To like have your kids being caught with weed. It's like, that makes you look bad. We don't want to look bad, you know?
Right. Right, 100%. Yeah, I got caught with weed in school myself. Yeah, and it was an ugly situation. So I get it. I just think it's interesting to like when we go through these stories because we can you know skip over the stuff and go really fast. But I think it's one way that we all connect and kind of go, oh, I went through that too, or my parents. I didn't even think about that. My parents did that as well. But it's for me, it's really illuminating to the disease and the culture that I'm in, how that stuff all went down, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. So you made it through. You were getting in a little trouble, nothing too crazy. You got out of high school, and now you're doing a lot of weed. You're digging the weed.
Doing a lot of weed and mushrooms. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
And I went to Berklee College. Like, I went straight from high school to Berklee College of Music in Boston. Which was, you know, okay, talk about unsupervised, and now I'm unsupervised in a big city with, like, a bunch of, you know, bars and you know, basically, you know, college kids and parties and and then it, you know, then my partying really stepped into another level. I didn't last very long at Berklee. I got thrown out in the second semester for various... offenses, you know, one of them being academic probation because I wasn't doing any of the homework, right? I didn't want to study. I wanted to party and play music, right? I just didn't know how to channel that playing music thing into the school realm, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was about jamming, smoking weed, taking drugs, going out to parties, finding chicks. That whole rock star thing was why I was a musician in my head, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be famous, and I wanted to be rich. And actually, what I ended up was thrown out of school and in jail. Right?
How? Okay. So, I mean, let's talk about the skills you have. So, you've been playing piano since four. So, you're probably pretty well known in the local community, playing in bands and getting some accolades there. And then to get into Berklee, that's impressive and that's cool. Were you pumped when you got into Berklee?
I was terrified. And I got into Berklee and I was like, holy, these people are all next level talented. I couldn't keep up. You know, I was just terrified. So I did my old diversionary tactics of be the party guy, be the guy with the drugs, be the guy that you want to hang out with. because I'm just not good enough to play on that level, right?
Yeah. Which,
you know, I remember sitting in the practice rooms with my jacket over the window so nobody could see who it was that was f***ing up his scale so badly.
I love it. Well, so, you know, fear is a big part of, you know, a lot of our stories, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And it's cool because there's probably people listening that know you and seeing you rocking out with, you know, Skynyrd or, you know, George Clinton or whatever. And, wow, that guy was scared in Berkeley. And I love when we kind of crack the seal and we get to see rock stars or whatever, people who are successful talk about the fear. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that successful people have the fear. Maybe somebody's struggling and they're saying, "Wow, I'm just so scared. I can't do it." And it's like, well, so is this guy who, you know, like, so is Peter Keys. Really?
Look, let me flash forward. I'll be sitting down on the piano playing Freebird in front of 20,000 people thinking, "God, I suck."
Oh, that is funny. Because I can relate, man. I can relate, you know. And
it's totally irrational. It is completely irrational. Like the fear, you know, I have, you know, I've pondered fear often in recovery, right? They're the two fears that we have. Everything boils down to fear.
Yep.
Fear of losing something that you have or fear of not getting something that you want, right? So that's the prime mover in humanity is fear. Fear of being eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. We learn how to run, et cetera, and so forth. So there are healthy fears, like my fear of drinking and using again, is part of what keeps me sober. But, you know, other fears like I'm not good enough, you know, the way that I navigate fear, again, as I was told to face fear, right, face everything and recover, or f*** it all and run. You know, and the other really cool thing that I learned is, you know, fear knocked at the door, faith answered, and no one was there. So when we face our fears, they basically disappear because fear is really an illusion. It's about something that hasn't happened yet. So the shit that we create in our minds, right? So it's not real. So that's, you know, something I have to constantly remind myself. If I'm afraid of something, it's because I'm making it up and it's not even real. And there's something that I'm missing or something that I'm not doing with my spiritual connection, right? That is allowing this fear to creep in. So I have to, again, they say fear and faith cannot occupy the same space, right? I have to have faith that my higher power will carry me through this, but that's a whole other conversation.
I love it though. This is great. I love that you're talking about that. And for me, and I think a lot of when I was new, and I think a lot of new people are like this, I was 2 years sober the second time. I almost said 3 years, and I'm 2 years sober the second time. And one of my good buddies said, you know, it all comes down to fear. And I was like, what? And I thought about it. I was like, oh, I guess he's kind of right. And then you realize, like you're saying, it's like, it is all fear. The reality is I didn't even realize it. So this is an important thing to share with people. And I think for newcomers, when they talk about how they don't like how they feel, they're brand new, a few days sober, everything they're feeling really boils down to that fear, right?
Yeah.
Fear that my life is a mess. I'm not good enough. I'll never recover. Whatever. It's all fear. All that discomfort really boils down to fear. So it's a great topic. And it's also great, like I said, to talk to a guy like you, who's a rock star, you know, playing with rock stars, and knowing that it's not that the fear necessarily goes entirely away. We learn how to run with it and we pull in faith. That's a great, that's a great thing. Yeah. Man.
Well, you know, I figure in, you know, my recovery at this point is all about transformation, right? So what is transformation? Transformation is a bridge between who you are and who you want to be, or where you are and where you want to be. And I, you know, I broke it down like this. Transformation can be, you can use it. If it's a bridge, think of a bridge in a song. You can use the same chords from the verse in a different arrangement to create a bridge to bring you to that last verse. So I can take fear and use that as a tool, transform that fear into action, right? So if I'm fearful of something, I actually step through that something, whatever it is. Say I'm afraid to do my taxes because I don't know how much they're going to take or how much I'm going to get back. I just go ahead and do the damn taxes, and then I find out what the result is. And then I bring in acceptance. I'm like, okay, this is what's so. This is life on life's terms. What's the next indicated action? All of a sudden, that fear is gone because I'm at the next step or the next level or whatever.
Right. And then, you know, what was great, I saw a therapist for a while, and she used to say, and then what? And I'd be like, what do you mean? That's all you're going to say? I'm paying you all this money. But
yeah, right.
I would say, what if my business goes away and I'm broken? She goes, and then what? And I'd say, well, I would do this. And then what? I'd do that. And then you realize it's not that bad. Like, what if you owed a lot of money on taxes? Well, I guess I'd have to make a payment plan. Okay, and then what?
Boom.
You
know,
you're like, oh, well, I guess it's not really that bad. I mean, I wouldn't like it, but I'm not going to die.
Right.
So I think it's like, and in that, what we're doing is we're embracing the fear. And I used to have to do it with corn, go play, and I would get scared. And somebody taught me, instead of like going, don't be afraid, don't be afraid, I would inhale the fear, literally like, okay, I feel it. Now exhale it. Like, you know.
Yeah.
It's great. I dig it, man. So you know what we should do? Let's throw in your song now. This is really cool. We're going to play. Now, is this song... Neither of these have been released as of yet?
They are both actually newly released. Sorry Not Sorry is that actually comes out, I think, tomorrow. If this is broadcast on Sunday, it comes out on the 15th, I believe.
Very cool. And so the first song I think we said we're going to play is song by you, Peter Keys, called Better Way. Do you want to set that up for us?
Yeah, Better Way is basically a song that tells the story of my last and final, God willing, DUI. You know, it starts out, the opening lyrics, I woke up in a jail cell feeling like a rag doll, you know, and I know a lot of us can relate to that, you know.
Yeah.
Locked up once again on a Sunday afternoon, and, you know, it was not the first time. It really is. It's just, you know, me owning that space, like recovery for me, you know, I heard and I've learned that my mess becomes my message, right? All of the stuff that I was so ashamed and embarrassed and demoralized about that I had done or that had, you know, happened, now is experience that I can share with somebody that is going through either something similar or the same and be like, hey, I actually was able to walk through this with this program and, you know, with help from other people. When I was willing to ask for help, when I was in enough pain to change, right, to change my actions, to have a different outcome, now all of this stuff that was a problem is now a solution. So that's, again, with transformation. I've transformed a problem into a solution. And just the identifying of the problem, me, I'm now able to work on that, right?
Isn't that incredible? We get this gift where we come in with a shame and guilt, and that those stories, the things we don't want to talk about the most, are the very tools that help us help others recover, like you're doing right now. So we're very blessed to have Peter Keys, keyboard player for Lynyrd Skynyrd, on Rock to Recovery Radio right now on KX93.5 FM. We're going to listen to Better Way.
Once again on a Sunday afternoon. Last thing I remember, I was headed down the highway. Came to with the blue lights howling at the moon. Picked up my effects at the desk from the deputy and headed back to the streets that I called my home. Walked 17 miles with my shame hanging over me. Kept telling myself, man, my cover's blown. I'm so tired of this town. I can't walk away when I keep falling down. There's got to be a better way. Be a better way. There's got to be a better way. See a better day. Tried one more time and got the best of me. I can't keep this shit out on my own. And that one last hit had me drowning in your sympathy, barking like a dog who lost his bone. Ooh. rescue me. He said life in the gutter to take its toll. And in front of the judge, you know I got the third degree. Said, son, it's too late to save your soul. I'm so tired of this game.
Better Way. And we are on Rock to Recovery Radio, KX93.5 FM, with Lynyrd Skynyrd, keyboard player, talking about his story through addiction, growing up as a musician, going to Berkeley, being scared to death to be around those other musicians, and actually getting kicked out of the school. By the way, I'm your host, Wes Gear, and this show's also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. So, Peter, stoked we got to play some music. Tell me, how did you get kicked out of Berkeley?
Oh, boy. Okay. So when I went to Berkeley, it was in 1984, and the drinking age had just changed from 19 to 20, and I was 19. My roommate was 20. I took his ID. He gave me an ID, and I put my picture on the back of it. So basically, I got busted with a fake ID, and the feds came in and pulled me out of class.
The feds?
Yes. Because it was a federal crime to alter a, government document.
Wow. And back then it was easy. It was much easier to falsify than these fancy things they make now.
Yes. So that's the short part of the story.
So they grabbed you out, the feds pull you out of class? How'd that feel?
It was humiliating. Oh my gosh. And then, having to call my parents and, have them get me out of jail. It was just really not cool, man.
So this is your mom and your stepdad?
Well, no, actually, this is my dad. So my dad was in New York. My mom was in California. So I had to actually call my grandparents who lived in Massachusetts to bail me out. And, my grandma was like, that's it. We're cutting your hair.
It's the hair.
Not the hair.
That's the punishment. Man, was that not the punishment of the 70s and 80s? If you screw up, you get a haircut.
Dude, it was horrible. And she was like she owned a beauty salon. That was her thing. She was good with scissors.
Oh, so it was bugging her for a long time.
Forever. Yeah, I'm sure.
Granny wanted to cut that do for years.
Yeah. So, that's the really short radio edit of this story.
So you ended up in jail.
I ended up in jail, yeah.
How long were you in jail for?
Just for that day. They got me out that night because it was,
bailed you
out. Big boy jail. We're talking Boston, Rikers Island or something like that. Yeah.
And you had to get your hair cut after that or went down? They cut the locks?
Oh, yeah. I had to get my hair cut, go to court and do all that stuff. Man. It was, And the thing is, that came back to haunt me, man, because, you know, stuff stays on your record, man. You know, that was a felony.
Oh.
Right? That was my first felony, falsifying a government document. And,
wow.
Man, it, you know, it literally took me a long time to be able to go and play in Canada, right, without paying a ton of money.
Yeah. People don't know. Canada, and I had the same thing with my DUIs going over there with corn and whatever. Canada gets mad. They if you have a felony or anything, they don't let you cross the border. I mean, even a DUI, they don't want you over there.
No.
So a lot of us musicians can't get across that border.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I literally had 5 DUIs.
Wow.
When I was, you know, over the next 20 years. So,
yeah. So where does it go from there? What my friend Brandon talks about all the time is, like, we have these things happen in addiction, you know, like we get kicked out of school or we get arrested or federal offenses. Did you think, hey, maybe I should quit this partying or this smoking weed?
Oh, gosh, no. That never crossed my mind, you know. I was like, oh, that was just bad luck.
Right.
Right.
It's bad luck.
So, and that, you know, the denial was already in, you know, the two big lies, right? I don't have a problem. I'm not hurting anyone but myself. Those were, you know, I totally live by that.
Yeah.
You know, if you had a problem with my drinking, that was your problem.
Yep. So what happens after you get kicked out of Berkeley and you get a felony? Where do you go from there?
Well, so I, you know, crawled back to California with my tail between my legs and started playing in bands on the, you know, on the rock scene in California. This was like 1985. I actually met at Berkeley. I met a good friend of mine, Jay Lane, who's the drummer. He was the original drummer for Primus. Charlie Hunter. He did many, many years with Bob Weir and Rat Dog, you know, the Grateful Dead.
Yep.
So he's like, hey, man, you should come out to San Francisco. I've got this band that could really use, you know, a keyboard player. And he'd fit in. And so I went out there and started playing with this band called Ice Age. Did, you know, a ton of shows just all over the little hole-in-the-wall clubs in San Francisco. Played around the scene for, you know, for years, you know. Working with, you know, the drummer from all the shrapnel music stuff, Mike Varney's label, you know, Paul Gilbert, Racer X, Tony McAlpine.
Tony McAlpine. I used to listen to that guy all the time. That's how you got with Friedman.
That's how I met Marty Friedman and did a little work with him, you know. So I was, you know, just really working the San Francisco rock scene, getting into, you know, some alternative, like, kind of funk type stuff. And really just, you know, played around there for, I don't know, several years, you know. So that was 85 to about 90. And then,
how was the drinking and using during that period?
Oh, it was great. it was working. It was
working.
Still working.
Yeah.
You know,
weren't getting in trouble. Bands weren't kicking you out cause you're vomiting on the keys or anything.
No, I pretty much kept it together. I was a functional, you know, functional addict alcoholic. I didn't get too wasted before shows. Of course, after the shows were over, there's, you know, all bets were off and there's no telling where I'd end up or how long it'd take me to get, you know, wherever I was going. But yeah, I managed to circle the drain for another decade, really. And you know, I think I got my first DUI in like 94 and you know, started that repeating cycle of like going to jail, not going to court, getting, you know, failure to appear, getting warrants, getting picked up, getting back in jail, going in front of the judge, pleading my case, you know, being the perfect victim, right? I was the victim of all this stuff. These were the cops out to get me because I had long hair and I was cool. These are actually people doing their job because you're an idiot and you're endangering society by being out and doing what you're doing. You know, I didn't see it like that. I was very entitled, you know, to my rock stardom, though I was making $12 a night, you know.
But the girls didn't know that.
That's right. Well, they eventually figured it out when I was, you know, bumming money off them. But that's what a good rock star does, right?
Yeah, what's the joke? What do you call in your case, what do you call a keyboard player without a girlfriend?
Homeless.
That's right.
Which is where I ended up, man. You know, I literally was living in a keyboard, sleeping in a keyboard case in a rehearsal space in the Tenderloin, you know, in 1996, when I had met a friend. He's like, hey, man, I got a session for you, but it's in Atlanta. I was like, well, I think my truck will make it. Let's go. And, you know, hightailed it to Atlanta, just really doing a geographic cure, you know. It's like, well, if I get away from all the drugs and alcohol here in San Francisco, I'll be fine. I'll be great. So I moved to Atlanta, where I literally fell into just a gigantic pile of cocaine. And
I hate it when that happens.
I hate it when that happens, yeah. But I had to get away from the speed in San Francisco because I hadn't slept in 2 years, you know.
You kind of left that part out.
Well, yeah, that was just the natural progression, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I really did just, you know, hit all the marks along the way.
Yeah, and you're still getting gigs. So you went to Atlanta. It fell into a giant pile of cocaine. And who was that gig? Or who's that gig?
That's when I found Funkadelic.
Okay, cool.
But the pile of cocaine was actually just the people that I was hanging out with around there. I literally went there for 3 weeks and stayed for 4 years. Kind of situation, you know.
That's a heck of a gig. Like, you know, I don't know how much people listening know, but this is George Clinton. Like, you know, if you're getting hired by Clinton to play keyboards, you have got some groove, some pocket. Like, that is ridiculous. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it was just, you know, I literally went out there with my friend Frog to go play on some demo that, you know, he was working on with somebody else. Ended up liking it in Atlanta because I didn't have all the wreckage that I had in San Francisco Bay Area, and just kind of started checking out the scene there. After about a year or so, you know, I got an audition with this band called The Original P, which was the original Parliaments minus George, right? They'd all been inducted into the Hall of Fame in 96. And they wanted to put a band together and tour the music that they had done with George, but, you know, they had a falling out with him. So they hired me on to basically cover all of Bernie Worrell's parts and the horn parts, because they didn't have a horn section. So I was doing double duty. Huh. So I toured with them. That was in like 98. I toured with them for several years, you know. But again, this was all really in the, you know, depths of my addiction. You know, that this is where my first, like, actual thoughts about suicide happened. You know, I think it was the day after my audition, I went and played a show with my original band called Picture of Health.
That's a funny name.
Yeah, it was a funny name because we were just a train wreck. And I think I broke a bunch of keys on one of my keyboards because I shoved it into the back of somebody's trunk because I was wasted at the loadout. And I get back to my house, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do the rehearsals because I broke my keyboards. I think I should hang myself. You know, I was that drunk that I was like looking at the oak tree in front of my house, trying to figure out if I had enough rope literally to reach the branch. And, that was my first like really low, low, low point. Just being wasted and feeling like my life was worthless, you know, that was still, you know, a decade before I got into recovery.
I can relate. That's the dark places we go, you know. You know, that first, that, remember we were talking a minute ago, the drugs and the booze are working and, you know, gives you confidence and it's a party. And then at some point it starts turning on you, me, turns on all of us. And it doesn't work anymore. And then we start having suicidal ideation or get really depressed or just our life feels like it's just in a black hole of poop. I totally get it. So let's do this. Let's throw in the next song. And,
oh, great.
And, and then when we come back, we'll hear how you hit bottom, got out, and found the way into the vortex of radness and the Skinnerd gig and all that stuff. So for those of you listening, this has been Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM. We're here with Peter Keys. At this time in his story, he's playing with George Clinton. And, he's currently the keyboard player for Lynyrd Skynyrd. He's sharing his story through addiction, and right now he's in a giant pile of cocaine and doesn't want to live anymore. So,
yeah. Not right now, but right now in my story.
Right now in the story, not right now in real life. Yeah, yeah. Let's be clear. So the song we're going to play is by your band, or you solo?
By me.
By you.
Yeah, solo. Yeah.
You are a band.
I am a band. One man band.
Yeah, so you want to set up the song?
Yeah, this song is called Sorry Not Sorry. And what it is it's a personification of the disease, right? And I'm singing about it as if it were a girl at the first verse. You'll listen to it. You'll get it. If you're anyone like any of us, you will completely understand.
I'm totally going to get the message right on. So this is Rock to Recovery Radio, and this is Peter Keys, Sorry, Not Sorry. Sorry, Not Sorry. We're here on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear, just listening to some incredible music by Peter Keys, and we're talking to him. He is the keyboard player for Lynyrd Skynyrd, telling us his story through addiction and getting out, kicked out of Berklee Music School and wanting to kill himself, hang himself off a tree, getting all bummed out in Atlanta when he's playing with George Clinton. So, Peter, thanks for sharing so much of your wisdom and also vulnerably, that's a hard word to say, your story and, you know, sharing us the dark spots. How did you end up hitting bottom and finding your way out of the darkness and getting into the vortex of radness?
Well, you know, I think it's much like everybody in recovery. It's like I just hit that jumping off point. What it was for me is, you know, I'd had several DUIs and you know, jail stays and fines and courts. And, you know, I'd gotten married. I'll try to make this quick. My brother got married. I wasn't invited to the wedding. I had the week off, so I showed up anyways. I ended up hooking up and marrying his maid of honor like 2 months later. She happened to be a bartender, and she had an apartment, which was great because I was homeless and I was a drunk.
So, Perfect.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, win. Go.
Crushing it.
crushing. Yeah. You know, so I totally like defiled my family and just, you know, made a bigger mess there. We got married and we had a pair of twins, beautiful, beautiful girls, Angela and Elizabeth. With, you know, we got married. Let's see, I went to the wedding in August, September, got married in October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June. The twins were born, July, August, September. I got another DUI. Then my mom was getting married to her now widower, because my mom's passed, but they were getting married and they wanted to give themselves a wedding present. So they did an intervention on my sister, who was also one of us. She's actually got one more year sober than I do. So the whole family went out there for the intervention. There was this great pair of interventionists that basically gave us the story, what was going to happen. They're like, look, it's a mixed family. So there's three of us, and then there's four of Bob's kids, my stepbrothers and sisters. And the interventionist was like, you guys cannot drink or use for 3 days so that we can do this with a clear head. And everybody protested, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Hell no, that'll never work. But anyways, you know, day one was everybody telling their story, learning about addiction and writing down their history of drug use. And I was like, oh, this will be great. I got this, you know, and I wrote a freaking novel. And the second day, everybody read those. And then, you know, all of a sudden the tables had turned and they're like, well, actually, your sister's not the only one that needs treatment. You also are probably going to die. And I was like, whoa, okay, that's not cool. But there was only money for one treatment. So, you know, it went to my sister. Hold on, there's another stupid call coming in. Let me call. Okay. So anyway, Steph eventually got in treatment. I was pretty shaken up because I was there with my wife and my new twins. I was like, okay, maybe something needs to change. And I called a friend of mine. He's like, no, man, you don't need treatment. You just need to accept Jesus Christ as your personal saint and savior, because really you're just making bad decisions. They just need to be forgiven and then you'll be good. And I was like, cool, I'm in. Sign me up. What do I do?
That sounds easy.
Yeah. He's like, I was like, cool, what do I do? He's like, repeat after me. I was like, you got it. He's like, I accept Jesus Christ as my personal saint and savior. And I was like, cured. So I didn't end up smoking weed or doing anything for those 3 days for the, you know, intervention, and I was cured. And I actually white knuckled it for about 6 months. And then at the end of 6 months, I got a record deal. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm sober. And like, now all these things are happening to me. I better celebrate. And so I went out and celebrated with a drink, which for me is two shots of Jim Beam and a beer back. Mm. And
is that what you came out of the gate with?
That's what I came out of the gate with. That was a drink, a double shot of Beam and a beer. Yeah. And literally within 2 months, I had another DUI. It was a felony because I was still on probation for the last one without a license. And I was facing 1 to 5 years in prison. And my kids, my daughters were not even two yet. And I was like, shit, I'm not going to see them until they're seven. This is crazy. This has to stop. So that, you know, what was really horrible is like, they put me in jail. They're like, do you feel like hurting yourself? And I was like, yes, but it wasn't because I wanted to hurt myself. It's because I knew that I could get a single room if I told them I was going to do that. And I was like, cool, I get to sleep in. Right. Mm-hmm. I was still delusional. But, after about 6 months of, being released on my own reconnaissance and going to breathalyzer tests and doing drug tests and all of this stuff, you know, I had finally had it, and I was like, okay, that's it. I'm not drinking anymore. And I went to play a gig with a band that I was playing with up in Detroit. I'd moved to Detroit at this point, and somebody was smoking a joint. I was like, well, I can take a hit of weed, you know, and I took a hit of weed. And next thing I knew, I'm at the bar drinking again, and I'm looking for blow. I'm like, what happened? How does this happen? And that was where I had that moment of clarity. I literally stood out on the porch at the hotel and looked up in the sky, and I saw two stars. One was pointing up, one was pointing down. I'm not going to say it was God, but something said to me, look, there's only two ways that you can go from here. You can continue the path that you're on, and it's not going to be a pretty end. Or you can change everything and get sober. And I got home and went to my first meeting, and that was on September 13th of 2002. And, by the grace of God and, by the power of the program and the people in that program, I have not had to have a drink since, and it's coming up on 17 years. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was my bottom, is just realizing that I was actually going to be locked up. Because what do they say? You either get covered up, locked up, or sobered up.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And so what was key for you in those early days for people listening or even now that helps you not want to drink, not pick up a drink, feel good?
Oh, my gosh, so much. I mean, the first thing is I felt hope as soon as I walked into that room, right? I heard people laughing and telling their stories and smiling. And I saw people with licenses and jobs and families, and they were telling my story. Like, they were literally sharing stuff that I had actually done, like word for word, stuff that I could relate to. These were people that got it. They felt the way that I felt, you know, and they seemingly recovered from, a hopeless state of mind and body and soul, man. And it was, you know, really compelling because I was in so much pain and I hated myself so much, right, that seeing that kind of community and honesty and recovery was actually what I needed and what I wanted. It looked like it was just a little bit less work than it was for me to go out and stay high all the time, which was a lot of work.
It's right? A lot of work.
Yeah.
And I always wonder too, which I get, because nobody wants to go into meetings. I mean, it's commonplace that everybody wants to rebel against that kind of stuff or 12-step programs or whatever type of program. But why go it alone? You know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to start a business, it's great to have people who finance your business and help you along the way. You know, whatever you're talking about. It just, why do it alone when you don't have to? I love it. And I love that you found your tribe there. That's what I was hearing.
I mean, you know, just looking at those steps and realizing that, yes, every time that I tried to do it differently, I still had a shitty result, right?
Yeah.
Something that I did not like. It did not come out the way that I wanted it to. And, you know, just surrendering to the fact that I can't drink or use successfully lifted a huge weight off my shoulders. That means I didn't have to anymore, right?
Yeah.
I did not have to fight that fight anymore. And by surrendering, literally, that's the only way that I was going to win that fight. Every time I step in the ring with drugs and alcohol, I lose. I don't like losing. I'm tired of losing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's amazing.
That's what Better Way is about, the first song, right? There's got to be a better way. And I have found the better way. Thank God it was there, you know?
So I love it. So here's the thing I want you to talk about now as we wrap up. I show that you got the Skynyrd gig in 2009.
Yeah.
And you said you got sober in, what was it,
2002? 2002, yeah.
Yeah, so that's 7 years in. Tell me about like how that gig came to be. And for those at home, because I got to tour with Korn totally sober, and people think that's, you can't do that sober. I'd love you to comment a little bit on how that came to be and how a guy like you stays sober in one of the biggest rock bands ever.
Let me preface this with, I think if I had gotten that gig one day before I got it, I'd probably be dead right now, because I needed every bit of the recovery that I had to handle the success that comes with a gig like that.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I got the gig just by, you know, by being a person of integrity and a person in recovery and a person that people could count on. Right. So through my first 7 years of recovery, you know, I still played, and I played with a lot of people, and I, you know, made my presence known, and I was, you know, at the best I could be at being, having integrity and being and showing up and doing what I said I was going to do and living by the principles that I learned in the program. Through that, you know, I was, you know, as you know, the music field or the music community is very small. Everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
So basically, when Billy Powell passed away, the keyboard player for Lynyrd Skynyrd, the guitar player, Ricky Medlock, asked Kid Rock's guitar player, because they were out with Kid Rock the previous tour, if he knew of a keyboard player. Well, Kid Rock's guitar player was somebody that I had worked with
during my recovery, not in recovery, he wasn't in recovery, but we had worked together, and I brought him into several projects. He brought me into several projects. So he knew of my, you know, he knew my skill set, and he knew that I could probably do the gig. So Ricky asked him, his name is Marlon. He's like, hey, Marlon, do you know anybody that could cover Billy, you know, parts? He's like, yeah, I think Peter Keys is in Nashville. Give him a call. So really, you know, it was a result of me doing work, being responsible, and kind of living this lifestyle, this new lifestyle, that gave him the confidence to, you know, to refer me to something like that.
So
I got a call from Marlon. He's like, hey, dude, are you in Nashville? I said, yeah. He's like, I need you to learn Sweet Home Alabama. Give me 3 steps. Call me DeBreeze and Freebird note for note. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, dude, I got you an audition with Skinner. I'm like, are you kidding me? He's like, no. I said, when? He's like, Saturday. I said, dude, it's Thursday.
And those Southern boys can play, man. This isn't, you know,
Oh, dude, I started getting into the Billy Powell piano parts, and I was like, holy shit, this stuff is intense, man. Like, it's no joke. Like, note for note means I had to go in and really study this stuff. And, you know, some of those piano parts are buried under those guitars. So I had to really use every bit of my musical skill set to break down what was going on in there. And once I did that, I gained, you know, the rewards were endless. Like, I gained a whole new appreciation for Southern rock, for Lynyrd Skynyrd, and for piano as an instrument, right? Which was my initial instrument. So, you know, those 3 days, I told my wife, I was like, Rachel, you're going to hear these 4 songs, and that's all you're going to hear for the next 3 days. And I literally practiced 18 hours a day, those 4 songs, found every piece of YouTube footage I could, trying to figure out his fingerings, and, you know, just copped those riffs, man, so that when I walked into that audition, I was prepared, because I was not going to let this one go, you know?
I love it. And I was just doing a podcast yesterday with somebody, and we were talking about like successful people, and it's that. It's like getting the opportunity, but not, you know, doing it half-assed. You 18 hours a day, you gave it your all. And that's the vortex of radness. That's not what the old Peter Keys probably would have done. And
no, I would have been like, yeah, I know that song. I'll just show up and be cool.
I'm going to interpret it my way.
Right. Which actually, you know, I was up against some really heavy hitters like Eddie Harsh, the keyboard player for the Black Crowes.
Wow.
Did exactly that. Like, he sat down and he played like, well, this is the guy. And then they played the songs and he didn't play any of the parts. He didn't get the gig, you know?
Love it. I mean, yeah. I love that you got it. So, wow, Peter Keys, Lynyrd Skynyrd's keyboard player, sharing his story from, wow, the darkness all the way into the light, into the vortex of radness. What a great journey that was. I really appreciate your time and you sharing with your life with everybody.
Well, hey, Ben, thank you for the opportunity, Wes. I really appreciate it, because this is a big part of my recovery and my daily life, you know? Like, we're here to carry the message and to help those who are still suffering, man, because it sucks being in that dark place. And it's super awesome being in the vortex of radness. You know, there's just no comparison. So,
yeah, there's no comparison. So thank you, Peter Keys. I appreciate you. This has been Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, also brought to you by KX93.5 FM and New Vista Behavioral Health. If you're looking for help, it's out there. Open your mouth. Ask for help. There's a whole world of people that want to help you. We're out.
Excellent. Thank you, my brother. We just want to feel good.